the prelude, the spiritual autobiography or the poetical autobiography. The prelude is the longest, novelest and the most fruitful illustration of the spiritual frugality of Wordsworth and the handsome anticipation of the modern concept of autobiography. As has been shown by Lindenberger in his recent study of the poem, here the aim is the preservation of the spirit of the past for the future restoration. Because the base of human greatness is childhood, which is father to manhood. And indeed our days are bound together by the fibered pity which the poet glances at in the remark that feeling comes in aid of feeling and a diversity of strength attains us if once we have been great. Such feelings of childhood, the great visionary experiences, are the spurs of time to which human mind may return again and again to drink energy and new vitality, as it were an inexhaustible fountain. One is reminded of Eliot's famous remark that it is the pattern which gives meaning to history, and pattern is formed in a selective process of memory as reviewed by the eye of the present. The prelude thus gives a pattern or meaningful organization of events and experiences, of pleasure and pain, of beauty and fear, which have given significance to the whole process of living and growing or the evolution of the present out of the past. It is in this sense that the prelude is an autobiographical poem. The great discovery of the 18th century, says George Pulet, is to have conceived the prime moment of consciousness as generative not only of other moments but also a self which takes shape by and through the means of these very moments. In the design and truth of autobiography, Roy Pascal has observed, Wordsworth is the first autobiographer to realize that each man constructs out of his world a unique framework of meaningful events, and that the deepest purpose of autobiography is the account of life as a projection of the real self on the world. Preparatory poem to be biographical. Let us begin by quoting out our poet's own words, the relevant words from the preface to the first edition of the Excursion in 1814. Several years ago, when the author retired to his native mountains with the hope of being enabled to construct a literary work that might live, it was a reasonable thing that he should take a review of his own mind and examine how far nature and education have qualified him for such employment. A subsidiary to this preparation, he undertook to record in words the origin and progress of his own powers as far as he was acquainted with them. The preparatory poem is biographical, conducts the history of author's mind to the point when he was emboldened to hope that that his faculties were sufficiently matured for entering upon the arduous labor which he had proposed to himself. This preparatory poem is the prelude, and the words quoted above make it crystal clear that it is to be biographical, as it is to record in verse the origin and progress of his own powers. It was Coleridge, the guardian angel of Wordsworth's poetical genius, who guided and inspired the poet to compose some philosophic song of truth and cherished our daily life. This was to be his greatest poem. The recluse, a literary work that mighty life. So before undertaking that arduous task of composing his great philosophic song, this poem began with the preparatory poem, the prelude, to serve more or less as a sort of portico to his Gothic church. But the irony of the situation is that this lofty venture of composing a philosophic song ended in a few hundred lines of the Excursion that was published in 1814. Meanwhile, composition of the prelude went on and was brought to a close in 1805 with his fuller project of a poem, including his experience in France and bringing history down to 798. When he felt his genius ripe for expression, the fact is that Wordsworth was a poet first, not a philosopher, as the friend of his heart and genius like him to be. Helen Derbyshire has rightly said, Wordsworth's genius could not express itself in colorist terms. He could not write the true philosophical poem. Perhaps no poet can. At any rate, he was right to follow his own bent. His poetic thought sprang out of a living body of experience and could only be delivered through images, incidents, and characters which belong to the life of man and nature as he knew it. The autobiographic form of the Prelude fitted his genius. Not an autobiography in the usual sense. At the very outset, it must be clear to us that the Prelude is not an autobiography in the usual sense. Of course, in the preface to the Prelude to the Excursion, the poet has told us that the preparatory poem is biographical. But he has also clearly stated that it conducts the history of the author's mind to the point when he was emboldened to hope that his faculties were sufficiently mature for entering upon the arduous labor which he had proposed to himself. So it may be biographical, but still not in a straightforward and chronological way. Here, events never follow each other in the order in which they happened. The poet has discarded the simply chronological arrangements in favor of one which would just stress on the essential importance of certain experiences and states of mind. To the poet, the subjective aspect is much more important than the objective aspect of the poem. So it must be clear in our mind that the subject is not my life, but the making of a poet. Although Wordsworth has used the phrase "the story of my life" at the end of the book one, and Professor Garrod has rightly said that the purpose of the Prelude may indeed be said to be the search out and seize and hold. Among the many seemingly alien and incongruous images of self cast up by the reflection, the image of the poet's true being, of his slowly self-realizing individuality, of that in him in virtue of which he is dedicated spirit. Poetic inspiration on his way to race down. Thus, in the very preamble of Book One, we can to a great extent guess the shape of things to come, and an unexpected legacy of a friend, Wriothesley Calvert, freed Wordsworth from pecuniary troubles, escaped from the vast city. The poet is on his way to race down from Bristol, and with the sweet burden of the heaven, he feels a correspondent breeze to inspire his soul, his poetic zeal, and very soon he feels himself to be a renovated spirit singled out for holy services, and a higher power than fancy gave assurance of some work of glory there forthwith to be begun, perhaps too there performed. Well, the work of glory was never begun or performed there. Instead, we got the Prelude, the finest fruit of Wordsworth's great creative period, records of inner life. So in the Prelude we get a record of that inner life out of which Wordsworth's poetry grew. It's the full intense life which he lived through his senses as a child and youth that he first tries to recapture and record. So in Book 1 and 2 we have Wordsworth's childhood and boyhood experiences amid the lovely natural surroundings. Herein lies the greater significance of these two books, and from the poet we get that his poetic life began, as it were, in the banks of the dormant when he was just a suckling babe, when he found himself baffled and plogged by a mind that every hour turns recurrent to her task. He appeals to the river dormant, was it for this, that one for the fairest of all rivers loved, to blend his murmurs with my north song. And when the boy Wordsworth was transplanted to the beloved well of Hawkshead of Estuate, it began to some extent consciously to engine influence of nature to shape and mould his character, and poetic personality had already started. Fair seed time had my soul, and I grew up, fostered alike by beauty and by fear. Awakening of the poet's love of nature. For the awakening of poet's love of nature is the most significant element in his early education. At the early stage, it was just a normal and healthy boy's love for open-air sports and pastimes amidst lovely surroundings of nature. So in books 1 and 2, we get an unforgettable recreation of his childhood, involvement in physical activities and the joys and fears which were their consequence. In the first two books, Wordsworth tells us of various exciting activities in which he used to take part in with all joy and zeal. In the first book, we have the following: bathing, bird snaring, bird nesting, an expedition in a stolen boat, skating, fishing, kite sailing, knots and crosses and curves. In the second book also, we find they still ran a western course and their favorite pastimes were boat races, boating excursions on the lake, walking tours and riding on horses through rough and smooth. Emotions of pleasure and pain. The first book is started with several impressive incidents showing us the means by which nature effects our discipline on young Wordsworth by evoking the emotions of pleasure and fear. Thus, on a hot summer day, the child would have pure animal pleasure by bathing or basking. Oh, many a time it a 5 years child in a small mill race away, severe from his stream, made one long bathing of a summer's day, basked in the suns and plonged and backed again, alternate all a summer's day. And then during his night adventure with the stolen boat, we find how he was overwhelmed with an alarming sense of panic and fright by the awful sight of the towering peak when the grim shape towards the towards off between me and the stars and still, so it seemed with purpose of its own and measured motion like a living thing stored after me. So the beautiful and sublime objects and images of nature with their vengeance influence enveloped his emotions and modeled his mind, and the poet tells us, purifying thus the elements of feeling and of thought, and sanctifying by such discipline both pain and fear until we recognize a grandeur in the beating of the heart. Three stages of poet's love of nature. Another very significant aspect that strikes us in the prelude, especially in the first two books, is that in it the poet has stressed three stages of his love of nature. We are able to mark three phases of development. In the first phase, as a child, we find the poet deriving simple animal or sensuous delight in nature. I held unconscious intercourse with beauty, old as creation, drinking in a pure organic pleasure. In the second stage, we could have more mystical and spiritual pleasure from his deep and close contact with nature. Then did I drink the visionary power and deem not profitless those fleeting moods of shadow exaltation. And finally, we find the love of nature leading to the love of man, and this change brings about a calmer and sober attitude. In this time of dereliction and dismay, I yet despair not of our nature, and in fleet for this uneasy heart of ours, I find a never-failing principle of joy, a poorest passion. Again, in the book 2 of the prelude, we are aware of the other three phases of in the process by which the transcendental or mystical relationship is established between nature and the poet. Wordsworth writes of himself, "Every man's life is best written by himself," said by Dr. Johnson. Wordsworth took the hint and produced what Lewis describes the unique autobiographical poem. Wordsworth's The Prelude is the greatest autobiography in verse in English, remarks when Gardiner, Wordsworth calls it a poem on my own earlier life. In the closing lines of book one, the poet says that it would form a part of the story of his life, which he aspired to record in the following books. It is again in book one that Wordsworth tells Coleridge that the poem would help the latter in knowing how the heart was framed of his thou lovest. Wordsworth admitted indeed that it was a thing unprecedented in literary history that a man should talk so much about himself. "It is not self-conceit," he wrote in a letter to George Beaumont in 1805, "that has induced me to do this, but a real humility. I began the work because I was unprepared to treat any more arduous subject, and diffident of my own powers. Here at least I hoped that to a certain degree I should be sure of succeeding as I had nothing to do but describe what I had felt and thought. Therefore, could not easily be bewildered. Tease a theme singled and determined bounds, and hence I chose it rather at this time than work of ampler or more varied argument. What Wordsworth's poetry and his personal experiences. The connection between Wordsworth's poetry and his personal experience is of the closest kind, and he undertook the writing of the prelude in a mood of self-examination. The poet aspired to create a literary work that might live, and he considered it right to examine his powers for such a task before he actually undertook it. The result was the prelude. The poem is thus Wordsworth's assessment of his own powers and a record of those influences that modeled him. The genius of Wordsworth is a genius that turned inward upon itself, says Raleigh, and in this psychological account of the growth of his own mind, and the most significant of the influences that saved it, he has done the biographer's work once and for all. His boyhood in Beloved dwell in the most memorable of all poetic boyhoods, and the first two books of the prelude, the highest levels of spiritual autobiography, and touch now then the highest levels of English poetry by simply recording with the perfect fidelity whatever it bore upon the growth of his own mind. His account of the act of stealth and troubled pleasure over the stolen boat ride in Book One is heart-thrilling and shows the poet in his boyhood years. The concluding lines, 340-400, of that incident and the experience it brought to Wordsworth are worth quoting. They move the readers because they record that and record what an everlasting impression the sight of a seemingly moving mountain created on the poet. After I had seen that spectacle for many days, my brain worked with dim and undetermined sense of unknown modes of being upon my thoughts. There hung a darkness, call it solitude, a blank desertion, no familiar shapes, remained no pleasant images of trees, of sea, or sky, no colors of green fields, but hues and mightier forms that do not leave, like living men, move slowly through the mind, by day and were a trouble to my dreams. Such experiences, as the poet says, became a part of his very being. How the poet's mind grew under the nature's formative influence. The theme of the influence of nature of man is the noblest part of the Wordsworth teaching in poetry. And that is the theme of the prelude, Book One. This book deals with his childhood and school time. There is no other work in English language where the early joy and wonder, the passionate, solemn, awe-stricken delight of the simple experiences of boyhood are more sympathetically and more graphically described. From his words we learn how Wordsworth received the education of nature, addressing the dormant, the poet says. Didst thou, beauteous stream, make ceaseless music through the night and day, which composed my thoughts, oh, more than infant softness giving me, among fretful dwellings of mankind, a foretaste, a dim earnest of the calm, that nature breathes among the hills and groves. Wordsworth, in his fair seed time, had wandered in the company of nature, seen her summer beauties and wintry colds, experienced her spring spells, that autumn mellowness. He had become, as it were, a part of nature in the same book, he says. When I called to mind, 'twas at an early age, I had seen 9 summers, it was my joy to wander half the night among the cliffs and the smooth halos on the heights I flied, my anxious vegetation hurrying on, still hurrying onward, moon and stars were shining over my head, I was alone, and seemed to be a trouble to the peace that was among them. Compare it with a passage from Book B. There was a boy, ye know him well, ye cliffs and islands of wonder, many a time at evening when the earliest stars began to move along the edges of the hills, rising or setting, would he stand along, when at the stretch or by the glimmering lake. It is the poet's reference to his boyhood. That boy grew to be a youth. He could not shake off those influences mind in infancy is like body in the embryo. Wordsworth has described the formative influence of nature on the unfolding mind of child. This unroofed school of nature attracted him more than the discipline of the classics, and he learnt more eagerly from the flowers and hills and stars than from his books. Love had Wordsworth found in the halls where poor men lie. His daily teachers were woods and hill, the silence that is in the starry sky, the sleep that is among the lonely hills. How beautifully and emphatically does he sing in one of his small lyrics. One impulse from the vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil, of good, than all sages can. He is unbounded love and admiration for nature is the outcome of the unceasing influence he received from nature during his early years. Wordsworth puts it in clear and emphatic words. The earth and common face of nature spoke to me rememberable things. Wordsworth continues to describe his wanderings in the midst of nature. It was his firm belief that nature took keen interest in the forming of human mind. We are told how he was led by nature one evening when he went alone in a shepherd's boat. In the journey in boat is described that the reader is told how a huge cliff rose between the poet and the stars, and like a living thing strode after him. The prelude, a key to Wordsworth's poetry. Thus, the prelude is not to be viewed only as a poem of Wordsworth's life. It is a key supplied by the poet himself to unlock the door leading to his poetic chamber. With the help of his long personal poem, a reader can understand and interpret the rest of Wordsworth's poetry more intelligently. It is a guidebook for understanding comprehensively the unbroken relationship between human life and nature, without which life to Wordsworth was no life. His childhood became responsible for making Wordsworth a great poet of nature. The prelude is the essentially living document for the interpretation of Wordsworth's life and poetry. Three things impress the reader of the prelude. Three things must impress even the casual reader of this poem. Wordsworth's love to be alone. He is never lonely with nature. He is less lonely when lonely. Like every other child, he spends much time in the woods and fields. He feels the presence of some living spirit, real though unseen and companionable though silent. His early impressions make him what he later on becomes. The child is the father of man. The prelude and Wordsworth's poetic genius. The prelude, book one, offers an instructive peep in the workshop of the poet. Through Wordsworth's own mouth, we hear of his mind's desire of gladly grapple with some noble theme, and how the mind, finding impediments of day-to-day renown, and was content to yield up to those lofty hopes. A touching reference is made of his unmanageable thoughts. We are informed that he possessed all that was needful to build up the poet's praise. He had the first great gift, the vital soul, general truths, nor was he naked in forms, images, and numerous other aids which are won perhaps with toil. The poet was invented by doubts. Had he the strength to assume so awful burden, would it not be wiser to await those malorias that bring a reaper mind? Are these misgivings valid, or are they mere timidity or laziness, a subtile from the selfishness cloaked in humanity and modest arm? But from this awful burden I will soon take refuge and beguile myself with truth, that mellower years will bring a riper mind and clearer insight. Thus from day to day I leave a mockery of the brotherhood of vice and virtue with no skills to part. Vague longing that is bred my want of power from paramount impulse not to be withstood. A timorous capacity from prudence, from circumspection in fight delay. Humility and modesty of themselves betray me serving upon to cloak. To a more subtle selfishness that now doth lock my functions up in a blank reverse. Now dupes me by an over anxious eye that with a false activity beats off simplicity and self-presented truth, for either still I find some imperfection in the chosen theme, or sea of absolute accomplishment that I recoil and droop. We find poems in their finished forms, but Wordsworth has described what pains a prophet had to undergo and what periods of uncertainties he has go through. Thus, poetic experience itself becomes a subject of the prelude and the presiding genius of the poem. Other influences on the poet. Besides the great influence that nature exercised over the poet's mind, we are told in book 5 of Wordsworth, Depth to Literature and Learning. It is true that the book doesn't deal in detail with the books on which Wordsworth had fed in his early years. But Arabian Nights, Spenser's Fairy Queen and Othello are mentioned as his favorite books. Influence of Dorothy and Coleridge on him should not be lost sight of. Two versions of the prelude and indications of the growth of poet's mind. A comparison of the 1805 and 1850 texts gives us further information about the growth of poet's mind between the two dates. The critics are not agreed as to which the two editions is better than the other, but the changes made in the original text indicate a change in Wordsworth's mental powers. Bald simplicity of 1805 gave place more decorative, more conventional literary form. Rough and crude expression is smooth and clarified. Faults of ambiguity and loose repetition are carefully amended. The most vital changes lie deep still, says Helen Derbyshire. They touch what we should now call it the psychology of the poem. In the early prelude, words were told of the inner working of his mind as nakedly and truthfully as he could. The changes must be deplored in his latter text are those which overlay and obscure that native expression. They often mar the poetry, more often disguise the truth. Thus, in the former version, the feeling is more genuine and spontaneous, less causes. In the latter, the style is generally speaking stronger and more finished. The first reveals personality more genuinely, the second reveals him as an artist. What does the poem reveal? It is generally when an autobiography deals with the author's childhood and first beginning that most often succeeds in reaching the hearts of his readers. Wordsworth's life, which is to many of his readers appeared to be a monotonous affair, comes out in the prelude as life. Poor energy from the beginning, wakeful, alert, self-willed. It is true that the poem is a story of the poet's own life, but its story by itself is not so important. The poem is the study of the origin of Wordsworth's poetic power. The prelude is less narrative than a study of origin, less the history of man than the philosophy of mind. In order to apprise the poetic genius of Wordsworth, let one read the prelude in which the sources of his poetic inspiration are to be found. A note of personal tenderness and almost elegiac inclination to evoke the memories of his own childhood make the prelude the most admirable record of soul's progress towards the full possession of self, which is implied in the apostolate of poetic calling. Louis Casimir read the opening lines of the prelude too. Thus far, O friend, have we, though living much, unvisited, unendeavored to retrace the simple ways in which my childhood worked, though chiefly that led me to the love of rivers, woods, and fields. The passion was in its birth sustained as might befall by nourishment that common sought. He also read, a child I held on cousin's intercourse, with external beauty drinking in a pure organic pleasure from the lines, the curling mist from the rebel plains of waters colored by the steady clouds, and yet mountains and ye lakes and wandering cataracts, ye mist and vines that dwell among the hills where I was born. I my youth I have been pure in heart, yet mingling with the river, with the world, I am content with my own modest pleasures and have lived with God and nature communing, removed from little enmities and low desires. The gift is yours. Keats' description of Wordsworth is egoistical sublime. The limitations of Wordsworthian temperament and of the poetry which mirrors it have been pointed out and dilated upon by many critics. His narrow range, his inequality, lack of humor, and of sympathetic understanding of other poets are their moods. Great emphasis has been laid on the lack of dramatic powers of negative capability. To that, his characters appear to be the copies of his own personality, and his best poems are in the nature of monologues. All these and many others which critical curiosity may discover in his poetry have been attributed to. What Keats was pleased to describe, his egotistical sublime, his complete engrossment with his own self, which made whatever he wrote significant and valuable in his own eyes, and led him to generalize from his personal impressions and pet notions and obscured his vision regarding the truth and beauty in the work of other writers. Coleridge himself has described him as a person wholly masculine and philosophical in his outlook. His proper title is Spectator and Ab Extra, although he is capable of the most profound sympathy with man as man. He is the sympathy of contemplator rather than a fellow sufferer. He feels for but never with his subject. There is substance in this view which compels acceptance, yet its full implication must be taken into account. Wordsworth has defined the poet as a man of speaking to men, though one of deeper sensibility and more comprehensive soul. He was not a nightingale singing in darkness, for Wordsworth was still a believer in the 18th century. Dr. Ryan, that the heart and the soul of humanity are the same everywhere and in all the ages, so the exceptional insight of the poet will be beneficial to the whole human race. He distinguished the poetic truth from the scientific knowledge and called it the truth operative. That is, truth carried alive into the heart with feeling, and concluded that the poet blinds together with passion the whole empire of humanity society. In the concluding verses, the prelude, he addresses his fellow poet Coleridge, and he tells him with the confidence that truth propagated by them will set society on the right path to love and liberty. If men under the influence of a natural weakness go astray and relapse into barbarism, the letter in which Coleridge requested Wordsworth to compose his philosophic epic clearly mentions its main object, which was nothing else but the revival and nourishment of that hope in the hearts of men and women which was dwindling and sinking under the stress of despair born of the French Revolution. He had not even the iota of doubt of the healthy influence of his works, and he frankly stated that they will cooperate with the benignant tendencies of human nature and society, and will in their degree be efficacious in making men wiser, better and happier.